Hey everyone, this is Josh, host of the Urban Valor Podcast. Today's guest is Veterans Legal Institute co-founder Antoinette Nador. Antoinette grew up on the East Coast, raised by immigrant parents. She joined AmeriCorps after practicing law for approximately 5 years. Shortly after serving in AmeriCorps, Antoinette served in the California State Guard for 6 years. As she became more exposed to veterans, she saw a need to tailor legal aid services to the veteran community, which led her to co-founding Veterans Legal Institute. Veterans Legal Institute provides free legal services to veterans who are homeless and or low income. In this episode, Antoinette shares some incredible stories of how she and her team have helped numerous veterans enhance their lives. If you enjoy this episode, go give us a 5-star rating and leave a comment to help support our veterans. The bigger the community, the bigger the impact. If you'd like to contribute your story to Urban Valor or know anyone else who may, reach out on Instagram at Urban Valor TV, or you can email me at josh@urbanvalor.com. Enjoy the show.
I'm Antoinette Nador, and I'm the executive director and co-founder of the Veterans Legal Institute. That's a nonprofit law firm that provides free legal services to veterans that are low income, homeless, at risk, mentally ill, and disabled. So I grew up on the East Coast. I am number 3 out of 4 kids. My parents immigrated to the United States in the 70s. My mom was 16 when she got married. My dad was 21. They didn't speak any English, so came to the United States and really they hit the ground running, working. They didn't have the privilege of an education or the opportunity since they both came from really low income families. But as a result, out of their gratitude for the opportunity to work and able to have this family and 4 children, all of who got to go to school and flourish, they're very patriotic, extremely American. We just all developed a strong sense of patriotism and gratitude for being born and raised in a country where opportunity exists, especially for women. Sure, you know, my dad is a foreign combat veteran and saw extensive combat. And I think that being able to raise his children in a country that by comparison is extremely safe, being able to have children that got to go to school. I mean, I'm talking elementary school, junior high school, college, ultimately getting a master's degree, in my case, in my Juris Doctor, isn't something that he probably ever dreamed he would have the opportunity of. And my mom is the firstborn of 9 kids in a farmer's village that were, you know, hardworking people. And she was sent to a Catholic boarding school. And that's where ultimately she met my dad at school when he was visiting with his relative. And I think the main difference in why they have so much gratitude, and it was just a common theme in our household, is because even though they were smart and even though they were willing to do the hard work, the opportunity didn't exist for them. They weren't born into the right families. They didn't have the money. And the resources in that country weren't as such to promote people that were just everyday common people. So their hard work was just going to keep them in the same place at the same level. And, you know, my brothers and my sister and I would have been in the same place had it not been for their immigration to the United States. They did. It's actually a really interesting story. My father, because he was a combat veteran, got his visa to come to the United States for them to send him to Vietnam. Our story begins in this country because of the U.S. military. And when he came here, Vietnam was starting to end. So he actually never ended up deploying to Vietnam. He never had to go through that experience. So, you know, it's an interesting kind of full circle situation with the family. You know, growing up as a daughter of immigrants in the United States, it offers me a unique perspective because I used to travel overseas quite a bit. And so it's like having 1 foot here, 1 foot there, part of you from the East, part of you from the West. And it's a constant contradiction of identity. And there's a lot of, you can't do this because you're female. You can't do this because you're a girl. And I spent a lot of time being frustrated about why I have to behave a certain way or dress a certain way or act a certain way or speak a certain way because I'm female. And ultimately, the way I reconciled it was, I'm going to behave the way that I'm comfortable with. As long as I'm good with God, I'm good with God. And I wanted to go to school. I wanted to go to law school. And I wanted ultimately to join the California State Guard. And I wanted to run my own nonprofit. I wanted to run my own business. And I felt that I could. And I felt that being female had nothing to do with it because I had the spirit of that service inside of me. And so it's unique because now that I've been in this position for over a decade, I get a lot of really encouraging communication from people. And these were the same people that when I was starting on this journey would tell me, no, you should just get married and stay at home. And I know that they did it with good intentions. And, you know, my mom stayed at home with us growing up. And I don't think I met anybody that ever worked harder than that woman. So I have incredible respect for it. But it wasn't my path. My path was a little bit different. So, you know, it was just a unique play on my personality growing up and really a lot of self-discovery on trying to identify, you know, what are my limits? Does being a woman, does having children, does where I live, does that stop me from following my passion in life? Does it stop me from working in a field that's male dominated? Does it mean that I should settle for less in terms of compensation or treatment or whatever it is? And ultimately, I just decided that I'm going to do the best I can and I'm not going to let anyone or anything stop me. Growing up, I attended a Catholic church and I was really inspired by the priest at that church. And they were constantly doing things for the public and it made me feel good. Selfishly helping others made me feel good. And I like that feeling. It's a feeling of joy, of empowerment. And, you know, while on the outside, people say, wow, that's so nice of you. But it's kind of like, well, it's also nice to me. And I like to be good to myself. So I always really wanted to work in public service. And I felt even at a young age that I had the ability to speak to people that were in crisis or have mental health issues or are homeless without fear, that I could talk to them openly or approach them and just start a conversation and be comfortable with myself and be comfortable with them and allow them also to share in that comfort. And I realized very early on, like, maybe this is a gift that I have. Maybe this is one of the few things I'm going to be good at in life. And why not focus on what we're good at? It makes us feel good. And so I did join the AmeriCorps after practicing privately in law for about 5 years. And then I spent a couple of years as an Equal Justice Works AmeriCorps Legal Fellow, which is like Teach for America, but for attorneys. And shortly after that, I had joined the California State Guard and I co-founded the Veterans Legal Institute because I thought, you know, in working in legal aid, people are in crisis. But as I started becoming more and more exposed to veterans, whether they were Korea era, World War II, Vietnam, OAF, OIF, Gulf War, I was like, wow, their reasons are different. And because their reasons are different, the solution has to be different. We have to tailor legal services to those who need them. And in order to tailor them, there has to be trust and an established rapport and understanding of who they are and how they got there. And that's how Veterans Legal Institute was born. Veterans Legal Institute, it's a nonprofit law firm, which basically means while it's a nonprofit, it still has to be profitable because we have about 20 people on staff. Attorneys, paralegals, admins, and we provide free legal services to veterans that are low income and homeless. And we get approximately 385 applications for service per month with a staff of only 20. So big heart, small number. And what we do is we utilize the pro bono legal community, so private attorneys that work at large and small law firms, and we ask them to take cases as well. And so you'll often see if you check out our website, we honor different attorneys in different law firms because they contribute lots of time and expertise as their way of paying it forward to our heroes in need. It's really hard to nail down one story because I can tell you things that will make you jump out of your chair and I can tell you things that will make you fall asleep. But every individual veteran's story is so important to that veteran. And for that reason, no case, big or small, takes precedence over another. We really like to honor the person, the veteran, and their service, regardless of how, quote unquote, important it might seem to the outside world. We provide services that are civil, meaning we don't do criminal law services. So people say, well, why would a veteran need an attorney? Or why would someone homeless need an attorney? And there's so many reasons. And I can say unequivocally that having access to justice removes barriers to housing, healthcare, education, employment. In other words, having access to justice, even if you're poor and you can't afford it, can make the difference between being housed or homeless. It can mean the difference between getting to see that doctor or getting no health care at all, ultimately life or death. And so it's really important that just because someone can't afford an attorney, that they get to access the very justice, specifically if they were on the team that defended it with their life. I'd say about 1/3 of the work that we do is in complex veteran benefit appeals and discharge upgrades. And I've taken some heat on the discharge upgrades in full transparency. But I want to let you know that most people who separate from the military with a less than honorable discharge probably deserved it. Not everybody is meant to be on that team. And I get it. We're not representing those people. Who we are representing are people that signed that check wanting to be in the military, and but for their military sexual trauma, or but for their disability that's connected to their service, but for that traumatic brain injury, but for dot, 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 they would have had that honorable discharge. So we want to give grace and not judge things on the face, right? Represented a Marine who served about 5 years, deployed to Iraq twice, model Marine. I mean, this guy's exo wrote him a letter I've never seen. Works with families of KIA till now, you know, years later, was separated from the Marine Corps a few months short of his contract finishing because he popped hot for smoking weed. Now, while he was on liberty, a tragic event occurred. This particular Marine went and smoked weed, went back to the base and popped hot. Not always, but a lot of times it's almost an automatic OTH other than honorable discharge. Now, this Marine was training other Marines, had seen a lot in combat. Like I said, model Marine, his exo wrote him a letter saying, while what this Marine did was wrong, and the Marine admitted that it was wrong, it was a first-time offense, and we have to look at the circumstances, and he deployed twice to Iraq, front lines, like really, truly an American war hero. We need to take this into consideration and rehabilitate him instead of kicking him out. But if we do kick him out, no one deserves an honorable discharge more than this Marine. Needless to say, he was booted out with another than honorable. As a result, could not access his GI Bill, struggles with PTSD from combat, where he can't be in crowded areas, he can't be around loud noises, found a lovely partner, married her, and they have 3 children, put himself through trade school and works alone in a room, in a quiet room, and gets by great. So when he came for his discharge upgrade, I said, why do you need it? That's always my first question. Why do you want the upgrade? And I won't forget, he said to me, ma'am, I don't need any of the benefits and I don't need any money, but I'm a Marine through and through. I love my service in the Marine Corps and I cannot live knowing that I have an other than honorable. I didn't deserve this. And so I looked through this guy's records and I'm so impressed by his military history, because when you meet him, he's extremely subdued, quiet, respectful, humble. And we took the case. And so the way a discharge looks like is it's like writing an appellate style brief and you submit it. And, you know, this was during times of COVID. We had the hearing with the administrative office over telephone. So it was me and the Marine and several people on their panel, including a doctor and other officers. I won't forget the examination of this Marine where they said, did you smoke weed or not? You know, did you partake in smoking marijuana? And he said, yes, I did. well, we shouldn't have done that. Well, he's like, I understand that. I shouldn't have done that. I should have sought other types of help. And I've been receiving help in the years since. Well, do you still smoke marijuana? He goes, no, I don't smoke marijuana. I ingest it because I have children and I don't want them to smell the smoke. Aha. So you're still doing it. He said, yes, I am. So when it came my turn to question him, I said, wow, after all that, you just admitted that you still ingest marijuana. He said, yes, ma'am, I tell the truth. And I said, why would you ingest marijuana? He says, well, my doctor told me I should, because when I went off of it for 30 days to do a trial, clinical trial with some pills the VA gave me, it made me suicidal. So my doctor suggested that I return to my methods of coping with my combat-related PTSD. I said, that's interesting. Who is this doctor? Where does this doctor work? He said, at the VA. I said, oh. I said, in what state when you were ingesting marijuana years ago, what state was that in? He said, California. I said, did you have a license to smoke marijuana? He said, yes, I had a license from a doctor. I said, okay, that's interesting. Tell me a little bit more. What did you see in service? And I'm not going to share with you guys the story that he told, because from my eyes in watching this 6'2" or 6'3" beast of a man break down in my office as he described what was nothing short of a nightmare, was hard for me to watch and hear. Even though I've been doing this work for over a decade, it doesn't hurt less to hear somebody's pain and watch it in their body as they break down telling you. They upgraded him from an OTH to a general under honorable. And the Marine was very happy. I wasn't, because I believe he did deserve an honorable. And I don't care what people think about politically. I don't smoke marijuana, but I do believe in rehabilitation. And I don't believe that you throw somebody away because they make a mistake, especially if it's a mistake against themselves. And so I look forward to the day where I can reapply for that Marine as my service and get him that honorable discharge, not because he needs the money and not because of my ego, because I believe he deserves it. And I believe very strongly that we should honor the service of those who really dedicated their life to that end. His story is one of many, not necessarily more important or intriguing than others, but he's somebody that I found was so strong throughout the ordeal and really touched me, because all he wanted was for someone to acknowledge his service as what it really was, and that was honorable. I always say a little grace goes a long way. Marines and other service members are human beings too. So people make mistakes. Sometimes the punishment doesn't fit the crime. Now, I'm absolutely not saying it's okay to pop hot while you're serving or at any time. You know, we have to love and respect our bodies. What I am saying is that we do have to invest in the rehabilitation of our military family and support these men and women are going through something before we just throw them away. Have I seen inconsistent punishments or consequences in the military? Yes, I have. Interestingly enough, I had somebody apply for services a while back, and he had popped hot twice for cocaine use in the 80s. And I was so fascinated because I'm like, well, I can't believe the first time. Like, cocaine is a big drug. It's a really big drug. So, it's interesting because a lot of times it will depend on the time of service. Are we in wartime or not? Do we need bodies or not? It might depend on your command. It might depend on your branch of service. It might depend on who you know. It might depend on your representation. If your JAG attorney is doing a good job or not. So yes, we have seen some inconsistencies, and oftentimes those types of human error are rectified. At Veterans Legal Institute, our rate of success is about almost 80%. So 80% of the cases that we submit for upgrades are successful. Now, like I said, we don't take all the cases that come through. We have to do our research and investigation. And if we see that this is a person that we feel is deserving and that there is a potential likelihood of success, we take the case. But across the board, if you are unrepresented, the likelihood of your success without an attorney is approximately 10%. On one hand, it could be because that's all the cases and some of them have no merit. But on the other hand, we can't deny that people who have representation, who can afford an attorney, or who find Veterans Legal Institute or other service organizations where they get it for free and they qualify and they have to go through those hoops, those are the people that are more likely to access justice and be successful. In other words, just because you're innocent or, you know, things went wrong and you should be vindicated, if you can't afford an attorney or you don't have an advocate willing to do it on your behalf pro bono, you're stuck. So justice isn't always served. There is a history dating back as long as you can look that when people start to act out in the military, just like in the civilian world, if you're working with someone and they start acting out, typically they get pushed out. So it could be that in your civilian job, someone is going through a really hard divorce and they just, their work productivity goes down, the quality of their work goes down. Do you want to ask that person, hey, what's going on? How can I help? Do you need a couple days? Can I support you? Or do you just want to say, you need to go? You're affecting our bottom line. There are people who have DD-214s where their narrative reason for separation is personality disorder. And it makes you wonder, did they have that personality disorder before combat? Or did something happen? And why didn't anybody ask? And if that personality disorder is because of combat or even developed during military service, should we rehabilitate that person before just cutting them out? And that's a question I can't answer. I'm not a policymaker. I can say from my point of view is that I extend grace to people in that situation. And I'll tell you a story. I had a case once for a young gentleman, got separated from the military for personality disorder. And I went through his records and he was just not happy. He kept complaining that he was getting headaches. And I think that people viewed that as he doesn't want to be deployed. He was deployed overseas, or he just wants to go back home. And he went to 3 military hospitals before they found a tumor in his brain the size of a golf ball. How that was missed, I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but it happened. We applied to change his discharge and actually to get him a medical discharge. Now, a discharge upgrade is difficult in and of itself, but to say not only like this person doesn't deserve a less than honorable, but they should have been medically discharged. And in this case, I wholeheartedly believe he should have been because he had a tumor, which takes time to grow. After his combat service, he really needed this medical discharge because the VA hospital closest to his house was over an hour drive. And it was too difficult with the pain in his head to sit in a car for an hour sitting up. And he no longer had private insurance because his father had lost his job. And they really needed to get this medical discharge so they could get healthcare closer to their house. So when I talk about access to healthcare, it's really personal to me. Ultimately, we won and we were able to get the medical discharge. But unfortunately, he had died a few days prior. So sometimes you win and it's really bittersweet because he suffered and he didn't get the medical care that he deserved. And the system doesn't work quickly enough. In fairness, he didn't die by his own hand, but I would argue that a lot of veterans take their own lives because their health care goes unaddressed, whether it's medical or mental. And it's not okay. There's no rational excuse for 22 veterans a day to be taking their own life. You know, at Veterans Legal Institute, we do estate planning free of charge for older adult and terminally ill veterans. We've showed up in the 10th hour at the VA hospital to help veterans in transition to their next life or to their death. We assist with bankruptcy and limited family law. But one of the bigger components are complex veteran benefit appeals. And I'm telling this story with a disclaimer. We only help veterans in Southern California in certain counties because I know people get excited and, you know, they want to apply, but we're a very small grassroots organization and we're only licensed in California. So unfortunately, we can't help everybody. And not because we don't want to, because we don't have the bandwidth. So many people need help. Some of these veteran benefit cases are so complex. We had a female veteran who was for many years living out of her car. She had been assaulted sexually in the military and really struggled with post-traumatic stress, as anyone would who has been sexually assaulted, and had no vindication. So her perpetrator goes on, it's okay, she's struggling. Someone helped her apply for her benefits, it was denied. It's really hard if you haven't been in the shoes of someone who's survived any sort of sexual trauma. So again, for that reason, we really have to pause in our judgment, because it's really easy to side with whoever we think or looks or smells more innocent, or did he or did she deserve it, or was he or she right? You really have to be careful and reserve that judgment until you know. In this case, this woman was extremely symptomatic of her PTSD. She could not function. Hence, she was living in her car for years. Her case was denied. When you are a survivor of such trauma and somebody comes back at you, especially an institution that was like family to you, that you trusted, that you gave your all for, and says, no, that didn't happen. Or no, you don't deserve our acknowledgement of that taking place in your life. It hits you on a soulful level that is extremely damaging. And I like to encourage people that will attack survivors of military sexual trauma or question their veracity. I want to tell them that if in the case that you're wrong in your judgment, that's a lot to deal with. Knowing that you, from behind a computer screen, re-victimize somebody who had to live through that. My theme is grace. We have to have more grace for one another and reserve judgment until we're sure. And be very careful not to re-victimize people who are trying to rebuild their lives up after a very traumatic event. And I understand that if you haven't experienced that, that maybe it's hard for you to envision what it's like to go through something like that. So I would ask you, if you do struggle to envision or feel for that situation, that you take some time before you speak out against a victim. Going back to this woman, she couldn't afford an attorney. They dropped the ball because it went up to a higher level of appeal. And very few attorneys know how to handle those types of appeals. So she had a hearing, and it was like, by the time she got to us, it was like in 3 weeks. And I mean, this had been sitting for years. We just had all hands on deck. Staff was on it, spent many hours reviewing records and testimony, and ultimately were able to prove this female veteran was in fact a survivor of military sexual assault, did in fact have PTSD, and received almost $400,000 in back pay. And when you ask, like, wow, you won her that much money, I think, no, we won her dignity back, and we vindicated her, because I guarantee you the part for her that brought her back to life was the VA saying, we believe you. This happened to you, not because of you. And we built her back up instead of pushing her back into the ground by calling her a liar or not believing her before we even looked into her story. It was a really beautiful day to have that vindication for her. And also, I think her story and her strength brings hope to a lot of other survivors out there, male and female, gives them hope and strength to not give up and to not keep quiet. My drive for running Veterans Legal Institute is definitely not financial, since working for a nonprofit is not a lucrative career. But it's such a rewarding career. And there's no amount of money that can replace that. If I could grow Veterans Legal Institute, I would. What holds us back from that is not the desire, it's funding. I had once helped a veteran with his benefits, and he was a combat veteran, a Marine. We got his benefits relatively quickly, and he worked at a large company. And I said, hey, we're having an event. Do you think you could give this to your employer? And by the way, there's another organization that I love. It's called Patriots and Paws. It's run by Penny Lambright, who's a saint walking on earth. I said, she's having an event too. Would you give these to your employer and maybe see if they're willing to sponsor? He says, no problem. And he comes back a week later and he goes, good news and bad news. Which one do you want first? And I'm like, good news always. He's all, the good news is we're going to sponsor Patriots and Paws because we love animals. I'm like, awesome. I love animals too. Who doesn't love animals? This is great. I'm like, what's the bad news? He goes, we're not going to sponsor Veterans Legal Institute because we hate attorneys. And I'm like, wow, fair point. This is the attorney who just helped you for free. But it was interesting because it's a wake-up call, right? People don't understand the power of having a free attorney. And when you're in the military, you have your JAG officer. The second you leave the military, you no longer access that JAG officer. And attorneys are expensive. And very few attorneys are willing to do public interest work because we get paid probably a third or less of what the market rate is for our private counterparts. So you really have to have the passion and the belief to do this work. We did recently expand to Central California because of a lovely angel named Beverly Novella at Westcare, who had a grant and said, hey, my veterans really need legal services. Can you guys temporarily help? So we were actually able to be there. It's a short-term grant unless it gets renewed. But I mean, if we can do it, we want to do it because it's really hard to access legal services. And so we want to bring that resource to veterans everywhere we can, because sometimes it's the difference, like I said, between housing and homelessness. Sometimes it's the difference between accessing your benefits and going to school or not. Sometimes it's the difference between being employed or losing your job. Sometimes it's the difference between life or death. But right now it's one day at a time, and we are just trying to serve the overwhelming demand in Southern California alone. I haven't taken a weekend day off. I work at least 4 hours, Saturdays and Sundays. I have a team who works 10 times harder than me. You know, because I'm the executive director, I'm the one who's doing videos and writing articles and going to events. And people always say, wow, you do great work. And I'm like, you know what? I stand by my work ethic. I do. And I'm proud and I'm not shy about it. My work makes me feel good. And I love to do it. And I love to spread the good news. But the credit really goes to my team at Veterans Legal Institute. We have got some legal warriors that just live their life for this cause. And they dedicate quietly so many hours where they could be doing that at a large law firm somewhere else and just making so much money. But to them, it's more important to fight for a cause that they believe in. And so our family at Veterans Legal Institute, it's just really inspiring to work with them. And they don't get the credit that they deserve. But at the same time, they're not doing it to get any credit. They're just happy to be of service. So we've had some really interesting cases involving older adult veterans and their spouses. It's interesting because I love when people say, why would they need an attorney for free? We have the widow of a veteran who's in her 80s and lives in her home. It's a very humble home that she bought 50 or 60 years ago with her deceased husband. And someone knocked on her door one day and said, you know, I want to help you. Your windows are outdated and old, and there's a government program. We'll replace all of these for you. And she doesn't, you know, she's taking this well-dressed man in a suit at his word. And little did she know after he had her sign the contract that he billed her about four times the value of those windows and then immediately sued her for the amount and put her home into foreclosure. And this is a woman, like I said, in her 80s that's lived in this humble home for a long time. who has a home but lives off of Social Security, a very humble lifestyle, and could never be able to afford, you know, the $400 or $500 an hour for an attorney to rectify this scam. This was a targeted scam against someone who's elderly, where they tricked her into signing something, thinking she was getting one thing. And then after a few months, they ballooned the payment, forcing her into default. I mean, her payment ballooned to like $9,000 a month or something. It was horrible. Now, this type of litigation is outside the expertise and resources we have available at Veterans Legal Institute. It is the type of litigation that requires a lot of resources and time. And so we were able to look to a law firm. In this case, it was Ford and Delio. We're able to take on the case pro bono. We don't want this 80-year-old widow of a veteran to become homeless because she fell for a scam that ultimately used a loophole in the law to get her into a program in order to foreclose on her home. So we try to fight when we can. If we don't have the resources, we try to farm it out and make our case, our plea to attorneys in the private community. We've been fortunate to work with hundreds of attorneys in Orange County and Los Angeles County, work hand in hand with the Orange County Bar Association to help us find those attorneys to put the word out there that, hey, we have veterans that have legal issues. We have veterans that are stuck in the family law court cycle and are unrepresented. We have veterans that haven't seen their children in months. We want to help bring that family together. And we don't want to do it by hurting one part of the family or the other. We want to bring the family together, but we need representation to do it. And ultimately, we want that family to come full circle and have a healthy co-parenting relationship. And so at Veterans Legal Institute, we really try to help, whether it's because we want to right a wrong, or we want to bring a family back together, or we want somebody to be able to get the health care that they need. Ultimately, there's never a boring day at Veterans Legal Institute. Every single day, there's something new that pops up. I've never gone to work and been like, oh, I'm so bored, like ever. Every day we go through these applications and it's like mind-blowing, the things that happen. I mean, we had one veteran who has cancer. It was storming really hard, which almost never happens in Orange County, California, but it did. And a tree fell on his house and caved his roof in. We were arguing it's the homeowners association that had liability. And we ultimately resolved the case for that veteran. But I mean, this guy was living in the house. Literally, you look up in his house and there's a tree. They were going to red tape his house. And how do you do that to a Vietnam era veteran who has cancer and say, too bad, so sad? And then we have some really small cases where someone's like, I want to change my name, or I want to adopt my daughter, or I'm a green card holder. I served in the Army. I deployed to Afghanistan, Iraq. I've had my green card for 20 years. I think it's time to become an American citizen. I mean, it's such an honor to be able to do that work for somebody and really come full circle and be like, hey, you did this for our country and we want to do this for you. 100% disabled veterans get approximately $3,200 a month. In California, legal aid organizations are oftentimes funded by the state bar. It's called IOLTA funding. So when an attorney, a private attorney, opens a bank account and you pay your retainer into that bank account, it's called an IOLTA bank account. The interest from that goes to the state bar, and the state bar in turn funnels that money to legal aids. Now, with that funding that comes from the state bar, are strings attached. They say, look, you can serve your constituency in this area alone, these types of law, and also they have to make under this amount of money. We really want access to justice for the poor. No problem. Unfortunately, for 100% disabled veterans, oftentimes their disability knocks them out of the income eligibility because they are disabled due to their service to this country. They are too rich to qualify for legal services, yet too poor to afford an attorney. It doesn't make sense. So a lot of disabled veterans would come to Veterans Legal Institute and say, hey, I'm getting $3,200 a month because I'm 100% disabled, and I'm getting $600 in Social Security. and I don't qualify for any legal aid because of it, but I'm barely paying my rent and I can't afford an attorney. So what we did is we contacted Senator Tom Umberg. Senator Umberg himself is an attorney. He's a veteran. His wife is a retired general. I mean, he's very active both in the legal and the military community. And I said, Senator Umberg, did you know disabled veterans are often discriminated against based on their disability that they developed or became worse because of their military service? And he says, what do you mean, Antoinette? I'm like, well, they don't qualify for legal aid if they're over income, and that disability income counts as regular income. And so ultimately, if they want to access justice, they need to not apply for their veteran benefits, which also doesn't make sense. And so we were able to work with his office and co-sponsor a bill so that as of January 1st, 2022, service-connected compensation is no longer included as income when it comes to determining eligibility for IOLTA-funded organizations or legal aids that receive IOLTA funding, which is the majority of legal aids in California. And so statewide, disabled veterans are now able to access justice at legal aids without having to worry that their disability is getting in the way or the compensation from their disability might make them not qualify because they're quote unquote too wealthy. So I was really happy, selfishly, because I'm like, oof, they can get help somewhere else. But also because from an ethical point of view, I don't believe that we should tax people for being disabled, especially when someone is born with a disability or they receive or their disability is furthered by their service to this country. So again, I'm really big on how do we build people? How do we rehabilitate people as opposed to how do we throw away people? And so that was just a really big win, I think, for veterans in our state. And one of the pinnacles of my career that I'm very proud of, Veterans Legal Institute and its staff was able to make that mark with Senator Umberg and really make a positive impact on accessibility to legal aid for disabled veterans in our state. So we have a website. It's vetslegal.org. And we are on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter under Veterans Legal Institute. For Twitter, it's VetsLegalOC. If you do need services and you live in Southern California, you can apply directly online through our website at vetslegal.org. But otherwise, we love it when people like, follow, share, tweet, pigeon, whatever it is you do on social media, do that for us because we want to spread the word about our services. And we also want to encourage other potential legal aid providers out there throughout the United States to provide these services to veterans. We are in no way competitive or hiding of the secret to our sauce. We want other people to do it. There's so much demand. If other people don't help, veterans are going to fall between the cracks. And that's a shame.